From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Some think teachers should stop discussions about politics in the classroom. Guess what? Kids are seeing those political ads, hearing you talk about politics.
The very youngest ones are sharing their parents' spiciest ideological sound bites in school.
A film documentarian takes on a years-long project involving his family, but finds the lens is sometimes too much of a buffer.
Everything in my heart, everything in my soul was saying, Rudy, put down the camera. Hug your father.
We'll hear why he doesn't. Daniel House finds investors are not so excited about self-driving cars and high-tech gadgetry.
The traditional business that built Detroit and spans around the world is still what really matters to investors.
We continue our series on helping veterans get the benefits they're due and the latest controversy about dirty surgical instruments at Detroit Medical Center. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. A little later today, Michigan fares poorly when it comes to connecting veterans to benefits. And that's 5 years after the governor started a new agency to do just that.
It's pretty disheartening to see this happening, especially considering the fact that most of the veterans here in Michigan are Vietnam-era veterans. We didn't take care of them when they came home. And here's an opportunity to do the right thing.
We'll continue our week-long series later in the show. But first, when I saw the Detroit News headline which read, Inspections began at DMC Hospital after dirty instruments allegation, I thought, what, again? Joining me now is the reporter who wrote that story, Karen Bouffard. Hi there.
Hi, Lester.
Let's go back a couple of years because your newspaper published a big investigative report about Detroit Medical Center and a history of dirty surgical instruments in the OR. Give us a quick reminder about what reporters found then.
Well, we did a six-month investigation, myself together with another of my reporting colleagues, Joel Kirst, that was based on about 200 emails we received from anonymous sources that showed an 11-year history of struggles with dirty surgical instruments that actually were endangering patients.
Now, that series of reports resulted in state investigations, and I thought DMC replaced a bunch of equipment and set up a new system so this kind of thing would not happen again. How did this new allegation of dirty instruments come to light?
Well, this actually came to light because there was a big dust-up about a week ago at the DMC concerning four cardiologists. Apparently, there are a couple of different teams of cardiologists that work at the DMC in the Heart Hospital, and there was a group of three cardiologists and actually the top medical executive at their vascular institute there who had been making a lot of complaints about patient care involving a few other doctors and but also involving processes and all kinds of issues, one of which was, they say, a continuation of dirty instruments at the DMC. One of the things that was reported to me was that there was a tray of dirty instruments that was discovered by an orthopedic surgeon during the summer. And this actually was confirmed to me by the Detroit Medical Center, which says, and the doctor who experienced this tray also says, that the tray never reached a patient. That is probably because the instruments go from a sterile processing center to the operating room where they're checked by a technician before they are ever brought into the sterile field, which is the area right around the patient that has a heightened security against contaminants. So I'm sure that it never reached the area where the patient actually was.
Yeah, but it sounds like the system actually worked.
The system did work, right? But it is kind of concerning how the tray of instruments was able to get through sterile processing. I know that the problem that they had in the past was that instruments were not being scrubbed before they went into the sterilizer. And as a result, there were lots of instruments coming back with blood or bone or different biological matter that had been essentially baked onto the instruments. And Although there weren't live pathogens, that's very unlikely since they'd gone through the sterilization process. It's still not a good thing to have those kinds of substances on instruments because the body can actually react to foreign bodies, and it can result in sepsis. So even though there weren't live pathogens, it was still a big problem, and it is still a little bit concerning, I think, that this instrument got passed the sterilization department.
What's the DMC administration have to say about these allegations by these doctors?
Well, they have made a lot of improvements, and with regard to the doctors themselves, they say that the issues had to do with violations of standards of conduct, but they have not specified what those violations of standards of conduct are. It's pretty unusual that a hospital, any hospital, would mention that they had demoted physicians. I mean, that happens all the time, but I think what was unusual in this case was that it was publicly announced, and the physicians believe that this was done to smear them, that it was retaliation for their complaints. What I've heard from the doctors is that it's been kind of an ongoing conflict with some other physicians, and that really they were being retaliated against. Hmm.
So the feds plan to investigate this. In the minute or so we have here, what's the worst that could happen to the DMC health system?
Well, if you fail an inspection as a hospital, it's very serious. Ultimately, if they don't fix problems, they could lose their Medicare or Medicaid funding. That's pretty unusual. In extreme cases, they have closed down hospitals. It doesn't happen very often. And another alternative is to just say a certain department at the hospital can no longer operate. So there are serious consequences, but hospitals are given many chances to improve. So even if they do fail an inspection, it's not going to happen immediately that a severe consequence is imposed. It would happen only after repeated attempts by the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare and Medicaid funding to services, rather. It would only happen after repeated attempts to get them to fix the problems, whatever they may be.
Karen Bouffard reports for the Detroit News. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. Have a good day.
The first National Coming Out Day was October 11th, 1988. It was a year after the National March on Washington for Lesbian and Gay Rights, where hundreds of thousands of people went to D.C. to demand an end to LGBTQ discrimination. Tonight at 6:30 p.m., the Ford School of Public Policy, members of the LGBTQ community at the University of Michigan, will share monologues about their own coming out to mark the 30th anniversary. We'll be sharing stories from a couple of those speakers, starting with this one.
Hi, my name is Brittany Williams. I identify as bi, and I am a 2017 Master's of Social Work and 2016 Sociology graduate of the University of Michigan. So the first time I came out was with the friend that I had as an undergraduate, but I would say the most important coming out that I had was to my dad, and it was a week to the day after the Pulse shooting. And at that point, I was out to everybody except for my father. I had a conversation with him. I called him and was talking about a whole bunch of other stuff, kind of beating around the bush. He asked me if I was dating anyone, and I said, well, I was in a relationship, but I'm not anymore. And he was like, well, you know, what happened? You know, was he this or that? And I was like, well, she and I made a decision mutually to break up. And he was like, she? And he was really shocked. And I remember him taking a pause and going, were the two of you intimate? Like, he was shocked and also kind of grossed out by that. I think he was so shocked that he didn't have the same sort of intensity that he often has when there are things that he's upset by in that moment. But in the weeks following, he would call and, like, ask me when I knew or why I was being this way. He at times suggested that the loss of my mother, which happened in 2013, somehow caused my queerness, that I was seeking the affection that I missed from her in women. That was really difficult, but I think it was an important conversation for the two of us to have. The main reactions that I would get as an undergrad were disbelief. So it was kind of like, you're just saying that you're attracted to girls because guys like it. I felt like I needed to have some sort of caveat when I would come out. Like, so I would say, you know, like, I am bi, but like, I don't think I would ever date a girl. Or, you know, I would date a woman, but in the long run, like, if I do end up getting married, like, I'll probably marry a man. And so me kind of downplaying my identity then turned into people doing the same sometimes when they would respond when I would come out. Initially, like as an undergraduate, I felt very much like I was having these coming out conversations, whereas now outing myself is more like a very casual part of conversation in the same way that straight folks are always able to do. Like, so I don't have to have like a sit down, come to Jesus with you. Like, I'm going to mention like, yeah, I was on a date over the weekend, really great girl, da da da, and moving on. One of the big things about my story and the reason I chose to go the direction that I'm going with my monologue is that I didn't get to come out to my mom before she died. So the title of my piece is Not Like That. And that was one of the ways that she would talk about encountering queer women as an undergrad. So she was on the basketball team and she would talk about how she felt like the girls who were queer on the team would sometimes like be flirting with her, like kind of checking for her. And she would go, and I would have to tell them, I'm not like that, baby. And I'm sitting there like, I'm like that, hi. But I didn't feel, you know, comfortable yet saying that. And so I know that mothers are very intuitive, and I'm sure that at some point or another, she at least had some sort of suspicion that I was queer. But in particular, when people in my life attempt to tie my queerness to her loss, like that brings up all my feels about never having been able to have that conversation with her. And so I think that's part of why it's so hurtful to me. But I also know that despite her flaws as a person and some of the homophobia that she exhibited, I really do believe that if I was able to out myself to her, that there was no way that she would have cut me off or never spoke to me again or anything like that. She was a very compassionate person. And so I'm sort of at peace now with that.
Still to come, the unintended consequences of mandatory minimum sentences.
We're this microcosm of this larger problem, and I wanted you to see yourself in this because I want you to realize that this can happen to anyone.
We'll hear how one Lansing family coped with a loved one in prison. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, filling in for Cynthia Caddy. It's time for a Thursday chat with Daniel Howes, business columnist for the Detroit News. Well, Daniel, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has dropped more than 1,000 points in the last few days, and the automakers have been hit too. But in your column today, you noted that they've not been performing well for a while. Let's start with Ford. What's going on there?
Well, I think Ford is in the middle of a restructuring, and the street does not see evidence of a traditional restructuring. These auto companies come out usually and say, we're going to cut X percent of our workforce, we're going to cut costs by a percentage, or they usually put a number on it, and we're going to do it in a very quick time frame. Ford is taking a very different approach, and I think this is frustrating investors who think that Jim Hackett, who's been in the job almost a year and a half, should have moved with more dispatch. And as a result, Ford shares have been trading below $9 the last couple of days. That's getting into global financial meltdown territory for Ford shares, although they would have more to go if in fact they got that bad.
I was going to say, even at $9, I mean, wouldn't you have liked to have bought some of that $2 Ford stock in
yes.
the depth of the recession?
Yes, I would, although I can't because of the work
right,
I do.
Right, it's a conflict for you.
But I think you raise a good point, but you know, look, General Motors in the same period of time, just since June, has lost about $17 billion in market cap.
You noted in your column that an investment in the new GM that was created right after bankruptcy, that wouldn't net much today.
Wouldn't net anything. In fact, in November of 2010 when they came out at $33 a share. If you'd have put $1,000 into that GM stock at that point, that $1,000 in today's dollars nominally would be worth less than $1,000. Last time I checked, GM was under $33, $32 and change yesterday and early this morning. You know, it's just not creating the kind of value. And it's interesting, CEO Mary Barra, I don't know, about a year and a half ago, said General Motors' goal was to be the most valued automaker in the world. Well, they've stopped talking about that. Well, why? Because they're not building the value. There was a run-up earlier this year to about $44 a share. They were looking fat and happy, and it's since settled back to below 33, which I think is a really interesting commentary on where smart money really thinks this industry is. You know, we've spent a lot of time on this show talking about next generation autos, mobility, autonomy, electrification. That's where it's going. Tesla's going to lead the way. That's where we're headed. Tesla is having a lot of problems. Elon Musk, their CEO, is very controversial, and they're trying to rein him in after the SEC whacked the company. And I think also what we're seeing is that at the end of the day, traditional cars, trucks, and SUVs and how much they sell and what kind of revenue they get and what kind of profit they generate is still what really matters in this industry. That's not to say that people aren't looking forward, but I think they're recognizing that the brave new world is not as near and nigh as they thought. And even the tech companies are starting to pull back and say, this is not easy. What you guys and we're talking about doing eventually is not something that's right around the corner, and it's not going to be easy to execute, and we are going to need partners. We can't do this by ourselves, and the car companies can't do it by themselves. So we're moving into an era of partnership here. But meantime, the traditional business that built Detroit and spans around the world is still what really matters to investors.
What do you think investors will need to see from the Detroit automakers before shareholder value really increases?
That they can survive a slowdown. Let's remember, we as consumers, they as sellers of vehicles, finance companies have been posting record profits and record sales in essentially a zero-cost money environment. Money's basically been free, or almost free, since about, let's say, for the last decade. So now all of a sudden you've got interest rates going up. There's another interest rate hike expected from the Fed before the end of the year. Three more scheduled for 2019. Money's going to get more expensive. Just this week, the chairman of the NADA, the Dealers Association, was in Detroit and said that they are now seeing on dealership lots people coming in saying, I'm going to replace my Ram pickup, for example, and I want the same trim level that I've got now. And they're finding out that that vehicle is a lot more expensive, that money is more expensive, and therefore when you put the price on the truck and then how much the money costs, people are going away and saying, I can't afford that. So they're either going into a vehicle that's not as well equipped, or they're going to use cars that have just come off lease. I think it's a real window into what's happening.
Daniel Hiles is columnist and associate business editor for the Detroit News. Hey, good to talk to you.
Thank you.
In October, HBO will broadcast a documentary about a Lansing woman caught up in a controversial conspiracy law and mandated minimum sentencing. Well, actually, the movie, The Sentence, is about a family dealing with the absence of a wife, a daughter, a sister, and a mother. The filmmaker, Rudy Valdez, put it together, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
And congratulations on winning the Audience Award for U.S. Documentary at the Sundance Film Festival.
Thank you. I still don't believe it. So when somebody says it, I'm like, oh my gosh, that actually happened. But yeah, thank you so much. It was amazing.
So let's cut to the chase. This story is your story. It's about your sister, Cindy Shank. Why don't you tell us how she got caught up in the justice system to begin with?
Yes. So my sister was the girlfriend of a gentleman in her late 20s, and he was unfortunately murdered in what the police call a drug deal gone wrong. And after he was murdered, basically all of the people that he was working with were all sent to prison, you know, immediately, basically. And my sister and another gentleman were not sent away right away. You know, the way you get sent away on a federal drug charge is to give information to other people. And presumably they didn't have a lot of information on my sister because nobody really went after her. Her case, we thought, was dismissed by the state and by the federal government. So she was sort of in this holding pattern for many, many years.
Right. And she wasn't charged for 6 years. What happened during those 6 years in her life?
When this sort of happened, we spoke to Cindy. It obviously was a very rough time in her life, and we encouraged her, you know, this is an opportunity to really get your life back together. You'd made some poor decisions in the past, and that doesn't have to define you. And she sort of took heart to that, and she really turned her life around, and she got married. She had two children, and she didn't know it, but when they came to indict her finally, she was pregnant with her third. So she was found guilty under the conspiracy laws because she was knowledgeable of the crime and did not go to the police. So when she was ultimately sentenced, her youngest daughter was 6 weeks old when she went away.
Hmm. She was first put in prison in Illinois, and that's drivable, but that facility was closed and she was sent to Florida, where it was much harder for her husband Adam and the children to visit. Here's a clip of conversation between Cindy and her husband.
Don't feel that strongly about that feeling?
Well, no, I do. I mean, don't put words in my mouth, but I mean, I just...
I don't know what they're doing. I don't know how they're growing. You don't understand. And to not see them now at all? Are you kidding me? I can't even wrap my head around that. I cannot do that.
I know.
Do you?
Yes, I know, Cindy.
So she's talking about not seeing her girls growing up. Over several years, you document how your family was dealing with this loss, this absence. Early in the film, you say about yourself, though, that being behind the camera was the coward's way out. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, so by saying that, you know, I was sort of at a place when I said that on camera that I had been filming my family and Cindy's daughters for quite a few years. And, you know, I wasn't a filmmaker when I started this film. I became a filmmaker to make this film. And so I threw myself into documentary wholeheartedly. My entire life became documentary. And I was working on this film. I was working on other people's films. And I was constantly filming, constantly with people all the time, oftentimes on their worst day or talking about some of the worst things in their life, because that's, you know, normally what you do when you're, you know, working on social political documentaries. And I was having this sort of, I don't know, battle with myself about if what I'm doing is for the greater good, if it's something that is going to benefit anyone. And, you know, especially because I was working on this film about my family and understanding that my family has to live with this for the rest of their life. And I literally, that film, that portion where I say that, I was setting up the camera because I was going to do an interview with Cindy's daughters. And, you know, I was just checking focus, checking the light and everything. And I just thought to myself, you know, I've asked so much of my family. I've asked them to be open and honest and vulnerable. And in my other docs, I ask these people to trust me and ask them to be open and tell me their life. And I've never done that. So that portion of it was part of the stream of consciousness that I was having. And I came to the realization that in a way, it is a coward's way out because I get to have this separation. You know, in my other films, I'm watching everything through this lens, so I'm separated. And with my family, one of the sacrifices that I made making this documentary was that I couldn't always be there emotionally for my family because I needed to hold the shot. And I started to feel like maybe it was a coward's way out. It was my way of coping that was selfish in a way. You know, I always tell this story of, you know, one of the hardest moments I filmed during this process was, you know, one of the times I'm filming my father and he starts crying. You know, and up until that point in my life, I'd maybe seen my father cry once or twice. And everything in my heart, everything in my soul was saying, Rudy, put down the camera. Hug your father. Tell him it's going to be okay. Tell him we're going to get through this. Comfort him. And then something else inside me started fighting me. And it said, Rudy, hold your shot. This is for the greater good. You promised your family that if they were open and honest and vulnerable for you in front of the camera, that you would make something good out of this. So I was constantly having this inner battle with me. And you know, it's something that I still struggle with even to this day, even with everything that's happened with the film. I still question, was I good enough to tell this story? Was I the right person to tell this story? Can I handle this pressure? And, you know, so that's where that sort of comes from.
You know, as we were filming, different members of your family dealt with Cindy's absence in prison differently. And there's a scene where your father is talking to her on the phone, and ultimately she ends up trying to comfort him.
I miss you, Dad.
I miss you, too.
I know you do.
I don't know what to do.
You don't have to do anything, Dad. You just got to, you know, just got to pray for me, okay? That's all you gotta do, puppy. Don't worry. I'm okay. I'm okay.
You know, there are a lot of scenes where, you know, it's really tough to watch. And I kept thinking, wow, you were there and you had to live it. And it's not just like any documentary because this is your family. So I'm glad you explained all of that to us. I want to ask you, you were not just documenting this. You were talking to lawyers about an appeal. When that didn't work out, you started looking into clemency. Now, that's an incredible long shot. Why even try that?
Yeah, I mean, if you see the film, you know, you'll understand something about me. And that's that in everything in life, I play the long game. You know, I'm never somebody that really goes for the quick fix in anything. I may do something immediately that seems like it's an actionable item, but it's always the long game. And when my sister went away, to be quite honest, I had this feeling that it was a mistake, that they actually made a mistake in sentencing her. I was waiting for somebody to say, oops, sorry about that. Like she was supposed to get 15 months, not 15 years. And I started doing research and I realized, you know, not only did they not make a mistake, but it's happening to thousands and thousands of people. And it was my sort of call to action. You know, I needed to fight. I needed to do something. I couldn't sit back and let this happen. You know, this film isn't about guilt or innocence. You know, my sister is guilty by the letter of the law. But what I could not rest with was the sentence. And I knew I needed to try and do something about it. So we went through the appeals process. And, you know, you get your first two appeals.
Just to be clear, the judge doesn't have any way to adjust that depending on the case. It's a mandatory minimum. That's the reason she got 15 years.
Exactly. Yeah. So she was given the mandatory minimum. The judge said he could go no lower. His hands were tied. So she was given 15 years. Yes.
The bright stars in this documentary were the three daughters, your nieces, Autumn, Ava, and Annalise. We watch as they're growing up, because this documents several years, and they're trying to keep their mom in their lives. What were you thinking as you interviewed Autumn year after year, and she just kept up that optimism?
You know, I credit a lot of that to her mother and her father. You know, despite what was happening, despite what happened within their relationship, despite anything else that was going on, those girls were always loved. They always knew that they were at the center of what everyone was focusing on when they were fighting for Cindy. So I think like that helped, you know, knowing that, you know, she had no fault and that she knew that we were fighting, whether it was just to get her to go and see Cindy, to allow them to remain connected, or fighting for her freedom. Like she knew that people were fighting for Cindy. And Cindy, you know, you mentioned it earlier, you know, she was comforting my father. You know, she had a mom on the other side who fought day in and day out to stay connected to her. And I credit all of that to Cindy and Adam.
When you do screenings of this film, I'm wondering, what do people say to you afterward?
It's interesting because there are so many layers to this film, and I've probably done 60 panels at this point, you know, 60 Q&As, because we've been traveling the country both in film festivals and impact tours and all of these things. And people all gravitate to different things. And I'd like to say I'm a genius. I don't think I'm a genius. But, you know, my approach to it was to make it something that everyone can relate to, that we're this microcosm of this larger problem, and I wanted you to see yourself in this because I want you to realize that this can happen to anyone. So people talk to me about everything from the lens that I chose to shoot the film with to, you know, how hard it was to sit there and watch your family go through this and hold your camera, you know, and then people ask, you know, what can I do to help change this? They ask, are these mandatory minimums still in place? And if they are, what can I do to make change? And that, to me, those are my favorite questions, because that's why I made this film, is to enlighten people on a subject matter that maybe they don't know about. And even if they do know about it, I get to show them this in a different lens, from a different viewpoint, because we never get to see in any of these films about this issue, we never get to see the true story of the people left behind and the other people doing the sentence.
Rudy Valdez is the filmmaker. The documentary is The Sentence. It airs on HBO on October 15th. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Now we turn to Jess Miller, a graduate student in bioinformatics at the University of Michigan, to share their story of coming out.
My name is Jess Miller, and I identify as a trans, non-binary, queer person. And back in 2014, I was able to have some gender-reaffirming surgery by having top surgery. I didn't initially actually plan any coming out. The first was to one of my friends in a bar, just mentioning that at some point I think I might get top surgery. And luckily, I got a very good reaction from my friend. She's like, Jess, I'm so happy for you. About a year later, I end up telling my parents very casually, almost, that I planned on getting top surgery within the year. My dad, he took it very well in the sense that he's like, all right, you do whatever you need to do to be comfortable, and he walked out of the room. But that should be given some context. When I came out as gay almost 20 years ago, we were a very conservative Christian family, and he was not okay with it for about 4 years or so. And so that was, you know, a hard time. He eventually came around to it, and funnily enough, my mom was the one who was okay with both things, and I'd never quite expected that. At first, I was just afraid that people were going to treat me differently, and I was worried that my parents would be upset. I worried that my friends would find it weird, and mostly, I really worried about what would happen to me professionally. But I never had a formal coming out to any of my colleagues or anything like that. I just quietly transitioned, and people took notice and either said something or didn't. There's all this stuff in the media right now where everyone's they're trying to push this to the forefront. This is me, and everyone needs to take care of it. It makes a lot of people uncomfortable. What I was doing was never for other people. It was so that I just wasn't horrifyingly depressed all the time. And so I felt like it wasn't really actually other people's business. So I didn't really talk about then because I was still in a very vulnerable place. And it's only now, this first year in Michigan, where I've come about to being more okay to talking about it. What really was a turning point was me getting top surgery. And at the beginning of that, I felt very vulnerable, as if all eyes were on me, and I tried to double down and just keep it more secret, though I did feel just more comfortable with myself. And within my friends group after surgery, I asked my friend Sherea, and her response was, "You just seem more Jess." And I said, "That's exactly what I was going for."
Stay with us. This is Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty. It's nearly impossible to escape talk about politics, but often that talk devolves into shouting. So when kids come home from school talking about a political discussion they heard in class and their parents don't like what they're hearing, the teacher often is blamed. People are defensive when their ideology is challenged. One legislator in Pennsylvania wanted to ban school teachers from talking politics in the classroom at all, at the expense of their state teachers' licenses, according to an article in the Washington Examiner. The legislator was worried about teachers indoctrinating kids. So how do you talk about social studies or current events at school? Well, let's ask a teacher. Batinga Ragatz joins us again. She was Michigan Teacher of the Year in 2011 and inducted into the National Teacher Hall of Fame in 2017.
Lester, I must tell you, yes, they do, and to a degree. You know, politics has become like cigarette smoke, right? You know, that stink is now getting in the clothes and it follows you everywhere. So kids are coming into the classroom anxious, they're confused, and they're concerned about this big elephant in the room.
Well, as a political junkie, I'm going to argue with you about politics stinking, but go ahead, I get your point.
Sure. I mean, you know, the point I want to get across is like, you know, students are going to remember these events, and so it's really important for them to have now in the present a place that they can unpack that event and quilt it into their learning context.
So in this context, do teachers play a neutral role in political discussions, or do they bring their own political views to the classroom?
No, teachers, we are professionals, and so we understand that there's, you know, like transference problems. So it's very important that you continue to keep a very impartial academic forum for these conversations to take place. It's very important not to paint your opinions with political colors, for sure.
What are teachers doing about this debate over whether politics should be discussed at all? I mean, are they just avoiding the whole issue, or are they using it as learning opportunities?
Many teachers are using it as learning opportunities. Current events have become an amazing teachable moment, right? So many teachers are really working hard to create learning experiences, not to confront the students' political ideologies or to change their political ideologies in any way, but it's a great time to really help the students seek understanding of why maybe the other side feels a different way that they do. And of course, many teachers choose to stay out. And of course, some administrators are pressured by maybe their boards to put a kibosh on all political discussions.
Well, we know both things happen. Some teachers don't say anything at all. Some teachers say, I don't care. This is what I believe. And I think it's important to the students that they understand my positions. So are there some sort of best practices for teachers who want to encourage political discussion among the students but not wade into indoctrination?
Oh, sure. I spoke to some teachers this week and I got some really good examples. For example, teachers of younger kids are using children's books about conflict resolution, kindness to others, accepting differences, bullying. But then in the higher grades, I have an example here. A teacher by the name of Nate Wright, he's a social studies teacher in Grand Blanc High School, and he's addressing the issue straight on. And the theme for his U.S. government course this year is, get this, a nation divided. The premise of this course is that the students are going to be taking a real critical look at national conflict and conflict resolution throughout history. And they're going to be looking at five big issues in our history that adults have basically botched, and then brainstorm solutions so that these issues do not follow them into their adulthood. But this is the best part. At the end of the semester, the students are going to be hosting a community event called Coffee House Politics. So they're going to be inviting community members to share the strategies they've learned for political discourse. And they're going to conduct these roundtable discussions and monitor them so that everything stays chill.
What is gained by being open to political discussions in the classroom?
What is gained is perspective. So children are listening to us, they're watching our TV ads, they are reading our social media posts, and the very youngest ones, of course, are sharing their parents' spiciest ideological sound bites in school. And so I want to make sure people are just simmering with that in a minute.
That was Matinga Garagatz, instructional innovation consultant, nationally recognized teacher, and Stateside's new education commentator. All this week, we're looking at why more veterans are not getting connected to the benefits they might be entitled to. Michigan has consistently ranked in the bottom five states and territories when it comes to helping veterans and their families access federal VA benefits. Since 2013, we've had a state office, the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency, that has been tasked with connecting more veterans to benefits. Our next guest is critical of how the MVAA has performed that task for the last 5 years. Stephanie Zarb is an Air Force veteran who served two tours in the Middle East. From 2013 to 2017, she was a program manager at a statewide nonprofit that serves vets. Cynthia Canty sat down with Zarb to discuss her concerns.
Stephanie, briefly tell us your experience working with veterans in Michigan.
So I had the privilege of being the program manager for a nonprofit here in Michigan that served very specifically Michigan's veterans. And in the 4.5 years that I worked for that nonprofit, we helped just over 4,000 veterans connect to various benefits.
So very much on the ground working with veterans.
Very grassroots, meeting veterans where they were in their local communities, yes.
And you argue that there's a crisis in Michigan when it comes to servicing veterans in our state. And you say that crisis is due to the difficulty in accessing veteran service officers. First, explain who veteran service officers are and why they're important.
So there's a bunch of different kinds of veteran services officers. So very specifically today, we're going to talk about what we call VA accredited service officers. And these are people who have been trained to look at a veteran's service record, their military service records, their medical records, and determine what benefits they might be eligible for. And when I say benefits, I'm not just talking about VA healthcare, although that is a huge component of this process. There are so many VA programs, federal programs designed to help veterans, and it really runs the gamut. They can do everything from vocational rehabilitation benefits to help a veteran get retrained into a high-demand career field. They can help homeless veterans get connected to what we call HUD-VASH, which is sort of like Section 8 for veterans, all sorts of benefits.
So a lot of programs, but then that hits me that that can be a very complex web for someone to figure out, almost like trying to go and do your taxes by yourself. without having the expertise of a CPA who knows the system. This almost strikes me it's pretty analogous.
It is. And I think, too, that putting that burden on the veteran is not only is it very complicated, but a lot of times when you're pursuing these benefits, you're going through a lot in your personal life. So it's one thing when you're doing your taxes and you do it every year and you start to learn, Mm-hmm. It's another thing when if you're a homeless veteran or an aging veteran that maybe is trying to figure out how to get nursing home care, or if you're a veteran who's just come off of active duty maybe and you're sort of dealing with that whole transition and now you have to try and figure out a very complicated, complex federal program. And on top of that, you might even not know that these benefits exist at all. So you may have no idea that they're even out there. You might not even know to go looking for them.
And you argue there are not enough of these veteran service officers. How do you know that?
Part of that is from my experience, personal experience, in trying to find a VA-accredited service officer to help my family. Myself and my husband are both veterans, as well as my father and, well, a good portion of my family are veterans. And then even just the other day, I came across the son of a veteran who was looking for a veteran service officer, and I was trying to explain to him how to go find one. And in that county, the office is only open one day a week for 4 hours. And of course, the veteran is also aging, so transportation becomes an issue. And it really drove home the point of not only do veterans not know that they need to go see service officers, but when they try to go do it, there's so many roadblocks. Some counties don't have a county office, so you have to go and try and find a service organization service officer. Other counties are only open one day a week, and if that person happens to be on vacation, there might be nobody there for a period of time, and I just think we can do better.
And it doesn't take much imagination to see how this shortage of service officers really impacts a veteran's ability to get these federal benefits.
Absolutely. You can go it alone as a veteran. You can apply, but you have to really understand this really complicated process, eligibility. And, you know, I did this 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for 4.5 years, and I find out about new programs I didn't know about all the time. So, you know, it's really that complicated, and it's really life-changing. If you see a good VA-accredited service officer, I've seen them do amazing things for veterans through the years.
They know how to navigate the system.
Right.
If you've just joined us, we're talking about the difficulty in trying to connect the nearly 600,000 veterans in Michigan with the federal benefits they may be entitled to. We're talking with veterans advocate Stephanie Zarb. So, Stephanie, in 2013, Governor Snyder signed an executive order that created the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency, and you were working with the veterans when this happened. What was your understanding of why the MVAA was created? Why was it needed?
The governor of the state saw that Michigan veterans were falling behind, that there was supposed to be this federal safety net to help veterans connect to services, that Michigan was really lagging behind, where we were 49th of 53 states and territories at the time, and said, okay, well, let's look at what other states are doing. A lot of other states have these types of agencies, and they're doing really well, really great, amazing things in getting veterans to connect to these benefits. So we saw a problem. We put the resources in place, a lot of resources in place, a well-funded agency to deal with this problem. We were excited in the community. We thought, finally, we are going to have, you know, this great agency. They're going to do great things. They're going to fix this problem. We're all going to work together, and we are going to take care of our veterans even better than what we're doing right now.
What about, since 2013, how has the MVAA fared in making more service officers available?
We saw a small increase in grants that were being made available to the counties to hire more service officers. We saw not a whole lot of movement. And I would say when you look at, is it easier today to refer a veteran to a service officer than it was 5 years ago? The answer is no. It has not gotten better.
So there have been two Auditor General reports on the MVAA's performance. Bottom line, what were the summary conclusions of those reports?
Sort of the overall theme is that MVAA hasn't been very successful in managing these contracts that are supposed to help connect veterans with their federal benefits. And in fact, if you open that last report, February 2018, the first finding of that report is that MVAA has not managed to connect veterans with their federal benefits.
And just this past summer, a bill by Republican Representative Jason Wentworth, who once worked at the MVAA, became the law. It sets up a $2.1 million grant program to encourage Michigan counties to set up and maintain veteran service offices. Is that a good step in your view?
That is the first good step I've seen in a long time. I am so thankful to Representative Wentworth for going and doing that. Representative Wentworth and I actually have known each other for a few years, and I think his story is really inspiring. You know, so he saw this problem that we didn't have enough service officers and managed to get elected, and then in his first term managed to get this through, which is really amazing. And I think every veteran here in the state of Michigan is very lucky to have people like Representative Wentworth looking out for us. On the other hand, I don't think that an individual should have to go through the extraordinary effort of getting themselves elected to the state legislature to take care of a problem when an agency was founded to take care of a problem 5 years ago.
If you've just joined us, we're talking about the difficulty in connecting the more than 650,000 veterans in Michigan with the benefits that they're entitled to. We're talking with veterans advocate Stephanie Zarb. You touched on the Grand Rapids Home for Veterans. That debacle happened in 2016. Instances of mismanagement and neglect and abuse became public. And that seemed to shift the MVA's focus toward veterans' homes. And the agency announced it's going to build a new veterans' home in Macomb. What do you make of that focus on veterans' homes?
Well, let's first talk about a veteran home is a nursing home for veterans. So we're talking about a nursing home. And I think when we say veteran home, sometimes that gets a little confused. Mm-hmm. There are two here currently in the state of Michigan, Grand Rapids, and then there's also another one, DJ Jacob Eddy, up in the UP. And the idea of providing nursing home care for veterans, that's something that's actually Civil War era. You know, that's when we started doing this. I'm not sure that state-run nursing homes are the future. The homes are looking at building, and you have to manage the home in perpetuity. You have to have a board that oversees the management of the home in perpetuity. And so they're very expensive. They're very complicated. And I think, honestly, we can say our track record on state-run homes isn't great. The one in Macomb, I believe, is going to have 128 beds. We have 600,000 veterans in Michigan, 128. Maybe not making the impact we could be making. The good news is there's an alternative for veterans. To me, when we look at it, there's a program through the VA called Aid in Attendance, which is a benefit that if you qualify for the state homes, you most likely, I can't guarantee it, but most likely are going to qualify for this benefit. So it's a federal government subsidy to pay for nursing home care. You can combine that with lots of different VA benefits. And then you can couple that if you have Medicare, if you have private health insurance, and you can go and procure a nursing home of your choosing. And hopefully in your hometown, too. So for me, if I have to go into the state-run homes, you know, Macomb, Grand Rapids, DJ Jacob Eddy, my family, we live in Southeast Michigan. Mm-hmm. And my hope is someday maybe my kids are going to come see me once or twice a month. I'd like to stay local, if possible. And through the VA, it is possible.
Now, lastly, the MVA just put out its strategic plan for the next 4 years. What do you make of that vision for the next 4 years?
So now that the nursing homes have passed their latest inspection, and they actually did pretty well, I think a lot of us thought maybe now we can turn the focus back onto the service officer situation. So we look at the strategic plan, and the number one point in the strategic plan was to continue to provide care and build all these new nursing homes. The number two point in the strategic plan dealt with veteran-friendly cities initiative and database to help translate military into civilian skills. I mean, okay.
You shrugging like,
I don't know. There's nothing wrong with that. I'm not sure that veterans are interested in living in like, you know, veteran friendly cities. But, you know, OK. And then the last point in the strategic plan was that they were going to invest in their employees with more flexible work schedules and different things, more training. None of those things are bad. But what's the glaring error to me is that nowhere in that strategic plan is there any mention of trying to get more veterans connected to their federal benefits, trying to make service officers more available, hiring more of them, doing a better job of managing the contracts that oversee that. So to me, it's a real miss, and I just think we can do better for our veterans.
Do you have faith that that could happen?
Not only do I have faith that that can happen, I have 47 other states that are doing it better than we are. So I think it's pretty depressing, actually. It's pretty disheartening to see this happening, especially considering the fact that most of the veterans here in Michigan are Vietnam-era veterans. We didn't take care of them when they came home. And here's an opportunity to do the right thing. So, you know, I'm asking, why can't we do it? Why can't we fix this?
Veterans advocate Stephanie Zarb. Stephanie, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
we conclude our series on Michigan veterans, we'll hear from the director of the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency, who says things are getting better for veterans. James Redford says benefit payments have increased nearly 50%, and Redford says programs to help more veterans have improved since a state audit revealed problems last spring.
We have improved it in a variety of ways, and I agree with the Auditor General that we were not doing everything that we should have been doing.
Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lenstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, Tyler Scott, Joy Horan, Sarah Leeson, and Natalie Brennan. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Talk to you tomorrow.